Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Ixne.
Makalua.
Becky.
What?
Hi. Your fan.
Yeah, I know. I'm holding my hand over the damn thing and it's so loud.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 289 of the Polycast here. This is Ixnay, just sort of pulled out of retirement by Dan here to guest on this podcast, joined here by some people who have presumably done this before. Mad Jin.
I don't know what you're talking about. Mackie and I are working on coffee.
The Mian team.
I have returned!
No! Oh, Makalua.
Hello.
And Mike W.
Waiting for a refrigerator Tetris to complete by Mackie.
It's kind of a mini game than a game, but here we go. Is there any strategic value to naval melee units? This is by Winged Nosering. Pretty much what the title says. Are naval melee units valued by anybody at all? Galleys help you explore early, but can't attack cities. They can't actually. Can't capture enemy boats until much later, and always get hurt when attacking. Can't heal outside friendly territory. So yeah, basically, not seeing much value in the naval melee. I don't use naval a lot. And I certainly build more range than melee, but it's kind of like the land units where you want some city takers or stuff that can occupy a hex or whatever, so I usually have a few if I'm going heavy naval, which is almost never. You get island plates or whatever.
Yeah,
right. Play that map a lot, but I mean, you would want a navy on island plates.
Yep. Melee naval units for me is, obviously, if you're on islands and you're playing naval, then range units can't take cities. But, shy of that, they have good time periods where the naval melee units are stronger than the cities, and then they stop at some point.
It's like a hose by walls, though, so you still need to shoot off the walls.
Yep.
If you can do that, you probably shoot off the city's hit points, too, since at that point it can't shoot back anymore.
Yep. And then you just ram it.
Ramming speed! Yep. So basically you want a couple, so you can actually take the city, but that's about it.
Yep. Although, I mean, there are times. There are various specific points, like get a free ironclad early, where they can do all the work for you.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Just start one-shotting or very nearly one-shotting stuff.
Yeah.
Or the range stuff hasn't caught up, so you can just kill all of it in one hit, so melee's more attractive. Although, then you're stuck with just boats in the water when the enemy doesn't have boats in the water. I guess you can go pillage whatever seafood resources. They're likely not working all that much, but... Although you could deny trade routes to a degree. Any trade route off of that island you could get rid of. So, but you can do that with range and naval too, so it's...
Yeah.
You can use them, but yeah, they're not greatly valued.
Yeah, outside of just having a couple on hand, I think.
Yeah, two or three destroyers to see them, submarines around, and that's it.
Yep.
That's true. You want to catch those.
Yeah, what would happen if... All ranged naval units were actually only one hex rather than two when you hit frigates.
It would make it quite challenging to do anything useful to land units or cities with them, that's for sure.
And maybe that should be the case.
Yeah, you can make a case for that until you get to the modern naval ships, which could actually fire inland a lot.
Yeah,
but the problem with that is that they're already so crappy.
What?
That I don't want to see like even less incentive to build them.
What, ranged
already
naval?
Naval in general.
Those are brutal.
Frigates are good. Frigates are good. I wouldn't say that the earlier stuff is brutal, per se.
Based on potential choices of promotions, if you go up the anti-city line on the ranged naval units, they can just wreck cities really quickly, even as quad creams.
Yeah. You need some work to set that up, though. I would say frigates are a lot more brutal.
Yeah. I think, they are more brutal because you hit two range and then you can pack more in.
But you have more maneuverability, too.
Yeah. But I would probably suggest you shouldn't be able to just take ranged units and wipe out a city regardless of if it's on land or water.
Yeah.
So maybe that one range limitation would be better for balance. And then you'd have to use more melee naval units to ram stuff.
And even that's not going to take the city, though. You'd probably need siege.
Yeah, I might actually have to land.
Ram applies. I haven't tried that out.
Yeah, I haven't tried that either. That'd be a little weird, but...
helicopters can benefit. Why not boats? It's the same thing, really.
Yeah, basically.
Although they nerfed the helicopters out, but the battering rams are still good for a long time.
Yep. But maybe you should navally invade, because it's not like anybody's ever taken boats and blasted a city and said, okay, we want it now because we parked our boat on your land.
Yeah. Realism versus gameplay arguments. Yes, I get it. The game's naval is so limited in its threat and utility that I hesitate to do anything that disincentivizes building it further.
No, but if there was reasons to make naval play better even on continents or Pangaea maps, like more trade routes are better through water or there's good resources out there that you want to protect.
Yeah, that could help.
One thing that melee naval units have that is not been talked about yet is that in Civ 6, you can attack with them against embarked units, and you don't lose any health when you ram them.
Oh, yeah.
So you can set up a blockade with
Navy
melee.
Yeah, that is for projecting power overseas, for sure.
Yeah,
if you want to... bring units, you can't kill them.
Yep.
A very, very usage case.
Yeah, it's pretty useful, especially when there's a flood of random crap trying to go around you by dropping into the water if you're trying to block them on the coast, and then they throw themselves in the water and try and go around, then you can put up a naval blockade.
It should matter on continents maps, too. Because on continents maps, once you've cleared your continent and someone else has cleared their continent or something like that, or someone's winning on the other continent or you're trying to survive and win on your continent, the Navy's going to matter at that stage.
Make Tall valid again.
Get small, son.
Population matters. Increase science or culture population, or both. Well, we had this topic by MyB7221, and he was talking about basically that in Civ 6 you have ICS as the most valuable strategy, and he wants to get Tall to be also a viable strategy in the game now. So...
The answer to that, son, is no.
We don't need to bring back the cancer concept from Civ 5. Thank you very much.
Actually, well, let's see. ICS is not king in Civ 6. Expanding is, but ICS is not. It's too much effort for no real gain over going wide. You can play against other people, and if you just say 10, 12, 14 cities, that's not ICS because you stopped. And you spread them out a bit. So that's still better. Districts are important.
Yeah. And you need to grow to make more than one.
Yep. Tall is not a viable strategy. Yep. Nope. Don't care. Even. I mean, let's call it. ICS is going super wide. Quote unquote tall is not expanding. Couple cities is not an empire. Too bad. Get over it. You have to expand a bit. But tall cities, which is probably the more important thread to pull out of all this, tall cities are important. You need to be able to get some tall cities into a game.
And they do confer an advantage. There's plenty of incentive to grow your cities in Civ 6.
Yeah.
Plenty of incentive.
But making pop matter, yes, is when you have a lot of pop in a city. That should matter a lot more. Increasing science and culture, let's just kill that right away since most of the thread completely ignored it. No. That should actually go the other way. So that pop matters more. More science and more culture just means if I've got 100 pop spread across 100 cities, I've got the same amount as you do from population if you spent 1,000 turns trying to do that in 4 cities.
I just want to point out, picking what land you're acquiring and how you're working it, how you're improving it, and how you're distributing your population onto that land is a central element of the strategy in the game. So if you are going to give a lot of resources, a disproportionate amount of resources, to just having larger cities, you do to an extent trivialize the importance of the land work.
Yep.
Also, contesting over land is a important aspect of conflict in the game and how you gain an advantage over other nations in the game. So having it at the point where that doesn't matter because you have enough incentive that you can get by just by not using half of the map, literally. You could see that in Civ 5 sometimes.
Oh, God, yes.
Size maps.
Civ 5
was horrible. It was like, land go and
use. Even smaller maps. Like, oh, I went 4 city tall, and so did the AIs, and look at the massive empty land in there at the end of the game. It's just like, no.
You actually had hard disincentives to not use that land, and then you had less incentive to compete over that land. In fact, you would disincentive. Conquering someone would actually set you back sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't see the upside of that from a design perspective, and I was happy to see it leave Civ 6.
Yeah.
I think the incentive should be take advantage of whatever land you can get, but you don't want to disincentivize trying to squeeze cities into literally every possible gap you can just to get the population there.
Well, I think there's three things, and this is probably a thesis, so be warned. when it comes down to how empires are built in-game, there's three primary levers that cause problems. ICS is all about the per-city bonuses. The more cities you have, the more bonuses you get, the more things you can do. So in Civ 6 style, ICS, the whole concept at least, is that more cities mean more quick districts, and you also get districts at low pop, so that you can just stay at sub-7 pop, get your 2 to 3 districts in, no specialists, no nothing. You just get a couple things in there and you're done. Because the districts are so powerful and you can spam them. I would agree. Especially if you incorporate the city-states in there where they give you plus per every district. That's all about the city. Just like Civ 4 or Civ 3. Well, Civ 3 more with the ICS. Where the
other than 5 had per city incentive.
Yeah, it's all about per city. That's why you want to pack them in as many as close as possible. Quote unquote, tall is all about the per pop. And overdoing the per-population side of things. And in theory, you can get that with ICS, but you go too far with a pop. Neither of those are working what has been said so many times, which is the land is the thing that matter. Use the map. Neither of those things actually affect how you utilize the map at all with cities. So both of those should be disincentivized so that you actually go towards the middle. There's a few problems with doing that, obviously, and the game just never changed. As much as the map is the thing, the game didn't change enough mechanics to make that viably correct in the respect of tall city versus wide. So, one, you can spam districts. You shouldn't be able to. There should be some sort of real limiter on if you put down a district, that should disincentivize you to expand or something. You shouldn't be going, well, I have a commercial district in every single city. No. You have commercial districts in high-value places, very valuable trade locations, stuff like that. But that's it. You don't just spam these things everywhere. Same for universities and encampments and all the other ones. There should be some limitation on the number of districts you can do. Population could be one of those. And the fact that you can spam districts out at one pop is crap. That should be pop 4 as a minimum, I think, personally.
If you can make a case for making it higher, even.
Yeah, I'd stick to pop 4 because you have to be able to get enough districts in. If you try and go tall in a city, like if an individual city's got a crap ton of food and you're trying to grow it, you should get benefits from that. So it can't be too much higher.
If you got a crap ton of food, you're going to get higher pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Unless, I guess, you don't have the fresh water.
No, there's also, I mean, even if you have all the housing for it and yada, 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 based on amenities, the maximum number of amenities you can get anywhere near the city, you're stopping roughly about 24, 25 pop, give or take.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
And when you divide that by, say, 8 or 9, there's only so many you can get in there.
Yeah, you can't get too far away from 4, I guess.
Yeah.
That's true.
But having it at 4 means you require one amenity before you can get a district for that city. So you can't just mass spam commercial districts and keep yourself below the amenity requirement for cities. So you have to put some investment in before you can get a district. That'd be my personal preference, is start at pop 4 for districts. Second part to that, you need less food to grow at low pop versus high pop. This has been a problem since the beginning. It is something that should have been changed in Civ 6 with the whole concept of centralized cities, especially when you start kicking neighborhoods. The whole concept is population moved to the big cities. So.
Oh, yeah. That was also more of a decent design choice when you had multiplicative multipliers for the cities. So you can have, like, plus 100% of something. That's part of the design rationale that originally made the higher growth requirements for large cities is because the value you get out of them was still greater than a pop growth in a smaller city, comparably. But that's not the true anymore, so I don't see why we still have the scaling.
Yeah, that really wasn't that true in Civ 5 either.
Well, no, but Civ 5 and Civ 6 have both held it over from early Civs, yeah. And it was absolutely crucial.
The pop growth concept needs to be changed, or a migration policy, or something.
Something that fits the mechanics of the current game, yeah.
Yeah. When neighborhoods kick in, you should see population either move to those big cities, or allow for, based on your housing, not just some small pop growth bonus. You should see way higher. And lower cities, if you kill off the fast growth in low pop cities, that'll also slow down your ancient era game. So you're not going to be in the Renaissance within 60 turns, where you actually maybe need some districts. To every district you slap down increases your growth potential, or minimize the box curve for low pop versus high pop, and effectively yeah. make it easier that when you're popping out neighborhoods, if you're trying to copy the Industrial Revolution concept of population move to the big cities, then you need to add that mechanic in there. It needs to exist for the game to still be about the land and not about going tall or am I spamming population in a single city or am I spamming number of cities. It shouldn't be about either of those still. That's probably one of the key problems that has to be changed. Is how food and growth, like even food should probably be more global or at least start local. If it starts local in an individual city and then as you go and you have roads and you have more infrastructure, food could be transferred from low pop farming cities to high pop cities.
That'd be such a major change. I'd like to see it though.
Yeah, I mean, food and growth has been one of those constants that has worked almost exactly the same as far as I remember going back almost all the Civ games, so.
Have trade routes generating it out of nowhere in the newer games.
Yep. Obviously, plus per building or in districts and stuff like that, some of the pluses aren't really that big. Obviously, there's the usual discussion of bring public schools back or that sort of thing where you get plus per pop from those instead. I think Mega Bears Fan was in one of the threads trying to maybe do public school per neighborhood, which starts getting really weird because you can spam neighborhoods and the game doesn't really work for a spammable district having buildings, because which one do you pick? But then he was starting to talk about science per citizens in the neighborhoods based on their housing values, and that just gets weird.
Yeah, it's too far out of what the game scope usually does.
Yeah, that's a little weird, but bringing back the plus per pop at a public school level or whatever, somewhere in that time frame, would be useful. That way, a taller city would get you more. But you'd have to do it in such a way that you would need, say, a second level building in a district to be able to get that bonus. You couldn't just spam it anywhere. Which brings to a different idea of not only should the number of districts be based on population, but how about the buildings? If, say, you can't build a university until you had 10 pop in a city, then all of a sudden you could add, say, 50% boost to science output from the city.
Yeah. It's true.
And then you know it's going to be based on the number of people in the city. So you're going to have less places where you're going to just spam. And even on that front, just to go totally weird, every building in every district could require a population slot or something. So you don't just, you know, build empty shell cities.
And you keep it at the city strengths, I guess?
Yeah, obviously. You built it. It's still going to be there. It's going to be empty, but you still kept it.
Yeah.
But that would require specialists to work the buildings. So each building can give a small bonus just for existing, but I would say that having a specialist in the building would be the thing that actually makes it get its bonus.
I guess you could do it that way, or you could just require have each building you own takes up your population resource, right? So you can only have so many buildings, and then you can't build any more until you grow.
Yeah, you could do that too.
And
but I'd probably do
it. It would be simpler, but yours offers more flexibility and strategy.
Yeah, because at least if you need a specialist one, it makes them useful. Since it's on the map and you can put population there, just like any old tile, makes specialists slightly more useful. It also means that you can't have specialist slots getting squished in, just because thinking the Civ 5 style where specialists were slightly more powerful at the time. So you do, like, that five-pop city that's running three specialists in the universities and stuff.
They are always competing with the tile stork, though.
Yep. That's why you have to make specialists equivalent to the tiles, or better, actually. I would definitely have the buildings better than the tile, but I would still require a population to use it.
The only danger there is you can get away from the map utilization again.
Well, no, that is part of the map utilization. The best
the
place,
buildings?
Yeah, because you have to put a district on the map, and if the buildings are, say, tied to the adjacency bonuses.
Okay, yeah, all right, I can see that. Then you're actually still working a tile, in effect. You're just doing it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I can get behind that.
Yeah, it's still behind. It's still
I wish I could argue with you more on this long thing, but there's not a whole lot I disagree with, really. So
yeah.
I can't make the discussion more interesting.
Okay, well, there's still some more stuff.
Okay.
Because
maybe you'll say something I disagree with more.
Yeah, we'll work on it. in the thread that started talking about Sostratus?
Yeah, Sostratus.
Somebody linked to Sostratus' thread about bringing back the height advantage, which is sort of what we've been talking about. And it's a little better on figuring out what the problems are in Civ 6 with some of that. The city center buildings, obviously, that all give some bonuses. Now, granted, if the other buildings and the tiles were better than some of the stuff that's in the city center, it wouldn't really matter. Like, I'm not building a new city just to get a monument, a greenery, a sewer, and a water mill. Well, maybe the monument, because that's too culture. You can't get that normally without extra stuff.
Yeah, but the other stuff would just be having a city for the sake of having a city unless you're doing something with it.
Yeah, because the greener the sewer and the water mill, that's not going to get you more stuff. Whereas the monument's actually giving you a yield that's viable. He mentions national wonders, and I think those are dumb. Totally ignore those. National wonders in Civ 5 were bad because they were tied to having a building in every single city. It didn't make sense.
It's another multiplier concept that got dragged over from a time when it made more sense.
Yeah.
And just it wasn't changed enough to fit the new mechanics.
Yep. A few big reasons why White is so good in Civ 6, where he's talking about removal of per city bonus penalties, but I think that's a good plan. Districts of buildings give plus X yields, not modifiers. And of course, he didn't mention that you can spam districts. Trade routes are per city and much stronger. I'm fine with that, but if you cut... The trade routes really aren't per city. It's more about the districts can be spammed. So we already covered that. And, of course, city-states, the 3/6 envoy bonuses are per district, which obviously is a bit rough when you can spam districts. But if you trim back the number of districts, then that's not as bad. Though I would possibly say somewhere in there that the 6th-level envoy bonus, instead of just being yet another copy of the 3rd-level bonus, there was no extra thought put into there. It could be that city-states give different bonuses to different buildings instead of just a flat to the district. So at level 3, you'd get a bonus to your universities. At level 6, you'd get a bonus to your research labs. Then at least that might help trim it down a little bit for the just your spam viability. And of course, everything's all about production, except when it's about gold. Or faith.
Yeah.
Production's the only thing that you need for districts. After that, you can buy everything else. I think to sum that up, there's a lot that can be done, and you're going to have to kill off a few sacred cows to do it.
Those cows should never have been sacred in the first place. They need their surrounding mechanics to make sense.
Yep.
If you want to still have something called that way, you have to just completely change the mechanic.
Yep. Change all the basic mechanics of the game just so that we can have something minorly different. Well, it'd make a better...
I don't think that's a fair summation. You want there to be decision-making that matters surrounding the interaction with these mechanics, and what you're proposing would actually require more consideration and thought more consistently than anything we have now regarding how you interact with terrain in cities. I'm not saying it would necessarily be perfect. You'd probably want to play with it a bit and tune it, but it's just a big step forward from, I'm just going to spam these high-value districts plus whatever is relevant to my victory condition, and there we go. There's not a lot of thought in that.
Yeah, no. I think my perfect empire for the Civ game, if we were going for like what style would be best, would be an empire that has a number of small cities that have specialization reasons, like why are they there, and a number of super tall cities. You have your core cities that grow and are the big regional control centers, and that's where you make your money, that's where you do your big research and stuff, but then you still have your smaller cities that have maybe one or two districts that are there for a really specific reason. You purposely choose each of those cities and what they're going to be based on what you need, not based on, I just want another city so I can drop another commercial hub. And four cities is, again, not an empire. Too bad.
It also doesn't encourage conflict, which is important in a strategy game.
Yeah, it discourages a lot of stuff. It's not just the war side.
If you remove scarcity as a factor in the game, then yeah, it's going to have a negative impact on the strategy of the game because you don't have the old scarcity.
Disgustipated. That's his fun name. I said that the past two games are showing how bad the mechanic is. Civ 5 implementation was no better than Civ 6. Think it's worse. I can't remember right now, but Civ 4 and 3. Other than Civ 3 and Saltpeter, get rocks.
Not having iron in 4 was a pretty big problem in the mid-game, too. It was uncommon to not have it, but it really sucked if you didn't.
Clearly, it wasn't quite Saltpeter, but it was still bad.
Like, if you're playing against somebody with a pulse, it was awful. No crossbows, no knights, no counter for knights, no pikes. So you had no way to handle opponents in the field aside from just slamming catapults into them. And that's not a very good mid-game strategy against knights. They'll wreck your day pretty quickly.
Yep.
Did you like that stack of catapults? You don't have it anymore. So his first idea was to completely eliminate it. Any unit can be upgraded anytime if you've got the technology. But in this case, having the resource gives them a bonus on offense and defense. He was going for plus 5 or plus 7. Is that
the
okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get wrecked.
Your argument is that the resource shouldn't be required, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if it's that high of a bonus, why would you not take, if it's only plus 1 or 2 or something like that, you might consider not. But,
well, like, it's pretty hard to fight someone who has a great general and you don't. And plus 7 is stronger than that.
Yeah, even if it was plus 5, you'd start stacking stuff up and yada, yada, yada.
That can quickly get into two-shot territory on BS, pretty much.
Yeah, equal level, 2 shots.
Yay!
One thing that's a problem, obviously, is that the spread of strategic resources isn't necessarily as good as it should be on maps. You can have some regions have absolutely no iron whatsoever. Might have all the uranium in the world, but it's got no iron in that whole region.
It seems like it's spreading them era-dependent. Like, this area will have the iron, that area will have, like, the coal, maybe some oil, and this area gets all the uranium. Because we've seen this in our multiplayer games all the time.
Yeah. Should probably, because it cuts up continents, try and make sure that every continent has a little of each, because that's at least more accurate. Or it should put in twice as much iron as it does uranium. Something. Iron's pretty easy to get. It's everywhere. You shouldn't be looking around going, we have none.
Yeah, we hate to bring the real-life argument to this, but iron's been found pretty much all continents, so.
It should just be a thing that exists.
Well, I mean, how about could further texts maybe reveal more sources of iron as basically it becomes more known? The idea is that you research a little further and then, oh, maybe it turns out you do have iron on your...
You'd have a hard time making that work with the current mechanics, though, because, like, the stuff that needs iron, you would have a hard time making a case to have more iron discovering texts, like, at the time where you really need iron the most.
And also, mechanically with the map building... That iron has to already be there.
True, yeah.
On the map.
Yeah, you would have basically like 4 iron resources that are actually the same ones revealed, and then just revealed by different texts. You could do it, but it's not going to add a lot.
And then you have other problems related to the map building and stuff, because sometimes you get blocked by putting stuff there for random silly reasons. Or you have your extra iron and you can't remove it or build over it. And now that best campus location is covered in iron and apparently, you don't know how to pave over rock.
Yeah, I could see the idea of it having, like, a tech further along reveal more iron, because there's places where you could technically get certain metals and all sorts of things, but you don't have the technology to make it worthwhile, because it's like getting, like, super hard rock or something like that.
Why not go the other way around and say, like, if you completed the next era of technologies, you get the strategic resource for free. Like, let's say you don't have iron,
yeah,
and you have to complete the ancient and classic era completely, then you get it.
You're dead by then, though, because someone's just going to say, oh, you don't have this, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, but you're not stuck on your units, you can't upgrade anymore because you don't have, like, I don't know, coal or anything.
I can sort of see where you're going. Basically, instead of having an actual straight-up iron mine, and therefore something that's a tile that's going to give you a tile bonus, that maybe after a certain point you find just enough iron floating around to be able to use it, but it's not concentrated enough to actually specifically hit a tile for the yields for working it. Kind of, but yeah, Bill kind of has the point there, especially when it's something like later eras where, say, no saltpeter, if you have to wait till the next era, then you're fighting 2 to 3 eras behind.
Good luck with uranium, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Uranium falls out at that moment. Yeah.
So.
Wow. More like, if you get nuked, you're probably not going to be building nukes in the future.
Yep. There could be ways of getting more iron. I think part of the problem was this, maybe the trade system. People can get iron. They should be able to get iron from other people without it being a government-to-government thing.
Yeah, you need a system that would work in PvP, not just like, oh, you don't have iron, you want iron, huh? Lol.
Yeah. No, but if you know, say, that your neighbor has iron, your merchants would be able to go over there and buy the iron. Have to go up to the king and go, hey, how you doing? Oh, you don't like me? Well, I guess we get no iron. They'd probably have to change the trading mechanic, which, you know, is not a bad thing.
There needs to be, like, some incentive to utilize these mechanics often in multiplayer instead of what actually happens, where the AI plays a different game and these mechanics are built around things that play a different game and not Sim 6. That would help a lot, yes?
Yep. Because then your quote-unquote trade-level diplomacy, you can actually introduce some diplomacy, and then you could do, you know, trade sanctions and stuff like that to keep people from buying stuff, yada, yada, yada. Actually add diplomacy levels to that. And I could see early game, the leader having full control, but then as you go through the ages, or if you go, say, to a merchant republic, you're not blocking people because, you know.
Yeah, there will be some shady gray and black market trading of all that stuff.
Yeah.
You could make a case to just abstract this and remove the resource requirement. You could.
I wouldn't remove the resource requirement, really, per se.
I'm not sure I would either, but you can at least make the case. I really don't agree with the second part of this thread where he's suggesting the auto-upgrade units and force you to spend money to do so.
No.
No,
it's fad. No,
that has fad gameplay terms, and he says it's more realistic. I call VS. Like, armies utilize things below their tech quite a while after that tech existed for... And used them well in some cases. Like,
well, there's little issues like, you know, pikes were used for centuries. And just because somebody had gunpowder, that didn't mean gunpowder was actually better than pikes.
Especially
it didn't mean cavalry of different sorts didn't go away, so pikes were still useful.
Yep. Of course, granted, having more types of units in the game would resolve a lot of that problem.
Yeah.
And, of course, having non-strategic-based units... like, say, a skirmisher that can be upgraded into a strategic resource using unit would probably be better. If you had iron, you could make iron swords. If you didn't have iron, you could still make all the stuff for, say, legions, just that your swords would be a little crappier. But then that dives into a completely different long mechanical change to make unit strengths more based on, say, their culture, the culture of war. Because formations were far more efficient than what weapon was being used, at least until you could blow everything up with one person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second idea he'd had in here was the thing about if you lose the resource, you stop healing. It's kind of...
No, that used to be there.
His real world point in is like, it's not like people went back to building knights when you didn't have oil.
Well, not knights, but cav. Cav was a thing with tanks. Granted, the first Lee tanks weren't that great, which made Cav still somewhat viable. The whole don't have the strategic resource, can't heal, it's the abstraction of don't have strategic resource, can't refill the unit's resources. You can always throw more people at a tank, but if you've got no oil, it's not moving. Rather than not healing, it reduces movement for, say, if it's oil, oil-based. Oil-based units that don't have oil, all of a sudden, don't go very fast. And, well, replacement parts are totally different. But, yeah, I'm okay with that. I mean, for me, the bigger problems with strategic resources in the game is that whole upgrade requires just one, and that's it. Whereas you need two to build. I would also suggest you should be able to upgrade units only when you're near encampment. So, say 8 range, something like that, just for giggles.
Yeah, I'm alright with that either way.
It also means encampment emplacements are important.
Somewhat. I mean, you just take a city and then you upgrade your units because they have an encampment too. But, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well. Yes, you could do that too.
That's what happens in practice.
Yeah. But you're not going to put, say, an encampment on the far side away from a neighbor that you're going to be fighting anyway.
Yeah.
Take a look at some more great people here. Let's rate some great engineers.
A fair amount of the engineers are at least not purely production, so they're kind of nice, giving boosts to amenities or appeal. Something some engineer somewhere said, let's make those nicer. But they're low, small bonuses, so they're not like that huge, look at me go, sort of benefit. Like the, here, have a couple grand worth of production towards a wonder. Or finish the space race project because here's just everything you need for it.
Well, one of them has a good chunk of production towards that, too.
Yep. But balancing that out, is there anything interesting? What's your best plan?
Like, what's the best one is how it's set up here. Or no, rate them.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, looking through this list, if I see one, I'm like, okay, this one's always better than the alternatives.
Well, I always like Tesla.
Yeah.
Getting the three tiles further.
Oh, more reach.
Yeah, more reach with that industrial district, especially since you can't overlap those things anymore. That definitely helps.
I like Nikola Tesla as well. That's my actual number one, but I've only got him like once.
Yeah, that's the fun random part. And it also fits in my empire style, where you'd have one big city in the middle giving production to all those little specialized cities.
Assuming you didn't place your cities based on the sixth tile reach much earlier, and yeah. Thus they're only getting it one or zero cities. But
yeah, you have to make sure that boosting it from 6 to 9 actually makes sense, and that you're going to get something. So you still get a little extra.
It's a decent amount of flat production permanently in the city you use it to, though.
Yep. Let's see. Obviously, you have your trigger Eureka moment for rocketry, and that's the only way to get it, or steal it, because somebody else will get it, but... Yeah,
space race project in half. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so Matthew's back. She likes the space race project stuff.
Well, that's the ones you seem to need the most help with.
Well, that's because they're so brutally expensive.
Yeah, and there's the two here in the atomic era that give you the +1 amenity, and, or, well, one is +1 amenity and +2 housing, and then +3 amenity and +4 housing. So if you got some big cities and you needed them to go taller.
Yeah, those are definitely
back
good
for the last topic.
Yep. Those are definitely good for that, get taller. I mean, the appeal also lets you get taller, too. So if you have the +2 appeal to any tile that you own, all those neighborhoods just got bumped up from crappy slums to high-end apartments.
Or to the Australia, that helps, too.
Well, there's that. Not nearly as many Eurekas as I would, actually.
Yeah, it's a lot of construction and this and that. And
well, I probably felt like shoving most of those into the scientists.
Yeah.
I'm surprised the ones that give production towards the wonder construction that it's just a flat number of gears and it's not like
a multiplier.
+2, yeah, a multiplier or a percent discount.
Yeah, that is true. There's no great engineer that gives you, say, 10% off all wonders in the city or anything like that. Probably should be.
I like how little effort we're putting into actually bothering to rate these.
We're telling you what's good and what's bad.
Yep.
That is rating them.
That's somewhat rating them, yeah.
The thing, I don't think there's any in here that I would say is just straight up bad. Because you have to keep in mind that you can't just pick and choose. It's all by the era.
I mean, a couple free walls is not, like, very game-changing. Although a lot of the stuff isn't very game-changing.
Yeah, but is instantly build both ancient and medieval walls.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
You got this guy and you had just gotten into the middle of a war. Boom! Try and get through that.
Yeah, it's not awful.
And since walls got changed to provide housing with monarchy, there's your growth again. I also like the insta-build of factory and workshops, and then factories get two extra production. Lots of production.
That was quite good, actually.
Yep.
A lot of hammers and a permanent effect.
It's like, oh look, I just got my industrial zone finished. Bonk. There you go.
Rate the great generals. Pretty much every great general will give +5 combat strength and +1 movement to nearby units. So they're all pretty close to interchangeable. There are some exceptions. Some of them are marginally better than others. But for the most part, they're not helping you a lot when you retire them. For example, this guy who gives you medieval and renaissance boost, or you can retire him for instantly creating a knight. Well, during the era that you're actually using knights, or really any medieval renaissance unit, you want to get the plus 5 combat strength and plus 1 movement. It's a lot stronger than a single knight. So you're not going to retire this guy until a knight is obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
He's still good to have, because plus 5 combat strength and plus 1 movement on knights is amazing. So you still take him, but it's not a good retiring effect. So he's functionally the same as any other random medieval renaissance guy, that unless their retiring effect is useful to you after the great general no longer is. So I would give a mild nod to somebody like the Renaissance Industrial one, Envoy move. That one is decent. And I mean, I guess you get a free core from El Cid once you hit Industrial or whatever. You can just make something into a core. That's all right. So you have stuff like that. But none of these that I'm looking at really strike me as amazing. And yet, I would be happy to get one or especially two great generals of any era, because they just allow you to smash everything. So well, it's hard to rate them.
The best general doesn't exist. The one that gives you ancient and classical era units.
Well, okay, yeah. But
there's no ancient generals, apparently.
Apparently. No. Some minor problem.
I also don't think there's enough great generals, or there's something wonky with it, because, like, the ability to deny multiple civs access to any general by just generating a lot of points is awkward.
Well, that's part of the switch from everybody can generate everything to
computer. I'm aware, but you can shove them out of era so quickly, so quickly, with generation and with tech, that it gets pretty asinine.
Yep.
And that's part of the reason great general stacking is so dangerous, is because there's an RNG element to how quickly you can get these things out. And
I think
they're limited enough in supply.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you shouldn't be able to stack great generals or great admirals. You should be getting the plus 5 bonus sets, not plus 5 per.
Yeah, you can go that route too. Even then, though, the complete lack of access to these.
Yeah, but being able to.
The problem.
Like, being able to take, say, all the Renaissance era great generals before anybody else gets one kind of sucks.
Yeah.
In theory, it's going to be competitive, and in theory, you should be able to spread it around.
Well, it's super competitive. Anybody with sense is going to try to fish them out in a competitive game. But that means that the people who are least equipped to do so, and sometimes it's more RNG than skill, are just hosed.
Yeah. Although, granted, since you can get stuff earlier.
Yeah, you can get a Renaissance guy before you hit that.
Yeah, like this stuff. I will take the free Bombard with an extra promotion, and I will burn him for that Bombard when I get him in the medieval era.
Yeah, I guess he could.
And then wait for the next Renaissance person that I don't feel like burning, Jeanne d'Arc.
I guess he could. I've never felt the utility sufficient in single player, but maybe.
Well, I mean, think about it. You get a Bombard that can effectively not just wreck a city, but reduce the walls and then more.
But, like, we're talking about a game that lets you stack two great generals on knights and just run around stomping the cities in short order and other units. I mean, the AI puts up some competition for some of these, but you can generally stack two great generals. And if you're doing that, I'm not seeing the huge attraction to creating a single Bombard unit.
I don't know. Bombard unit that can just wreck anything in one shot?
But so can two knights. Like.
Yeah. Just depends. Style.
I suppose. Mix it up a little bit with what you're shredding the AI with.
Yeah.
I guess.
Not a big fan of the form armies or cores, because they don't really give much. But
something. Like, you can retire them and you get something. I like that more than making a knight fight. It's basically giving you a unit that's relevant to your era instead of giving you a unit that's almost certainly already obsolete.
Yeah. Well, I take all of the unit ones based on getting them early, because they're all going to show up early just because of the way that the game is set up right now to get great people.
Sacrificing your knight booster to get a knight a little early, though, that really hurts.
Yeah.
Because you can get the knights pretty darn quick, and then once you do, that plus 5 and plus 1 movement especially are really nice to have. 6-7 new knights are devastating.
But I've already got Cid.
Keep them both?
Yeah.
There's no reason not to.
Yeah. Well, that should be fixed.
Well, until it is fixed, you want the plus 10 and plus 2 movement.
Yeah. Otherwise,
if we're going to rate them based on the current rules, then you want both.
But otherwise, I'd say I would probably agree that all of the generals that give you something to use after no longer giving you the boost,
Genghis's plus one promotion and more combat experience to a military land unit is great after you've upgraded into the industrial or later era units.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, okay, you're done. Here, go be useful. Merchants. They exist.
Oh, yeah. But actually, a lot of these are pretty good.
Well, yeah, I think that's the downfall of the competitive in the split, is the merchants ended up being all the really good ones.
Yeah, that still feels weird to me as a Civ 4 player, when merchants are certainly a useful, great person to generate, but man, were great scientists dominant. I guess that was also true in 5, scientists were better.
Yeah, well, scientists were better in 5 because you just bulbed the last half of the tech tree in one go. That was
pretty
really
much.
Stupid. As Drew has pointed out before we even started talking about the merchants, number one, Adam Smith. Number two, anything that gives you amenities. Number three, something else.
Listen, bringing back the Beyond Earth memories from Imagine, the Adam Smith thing. Yeah.
Drew, you're Smith. No, but even in this one, Adam Smith is the best one. Like, it's just obvious. One whole economic policy slot?
Yeah.
Permanent ad.
Permanent ad, yeah, please. Yoink.
It's hard.
Yeah, you can't really argue that one. So for the not Adam Smith people.
Rockefeller, in case your oil is all offshore.
Yep, that. Rockefeller giving you the one oil.
And then the extra gold on the trade routes when the destination city has strategic resources too, which is nice.
Yeah, for each one.
Yeah, each one. That can add up.
Generating luxuries from nowhere is also nice.
Yes.
Oh yeah, there's like, what is it, three of those.
Yeah, there's three.
Cosmetics, toys, jeans.
Yeah. See, I like those ones gameplay-wise for merchants because that works. Plus, you also get two of them. So you get one for yourself and you can trade one.
Yeah. Which also makes them quite powerful because in addition to getting the amenities, you get whatever utility you get from the trade, which can be quite significant.
Although I guess for that, it'd be kind of interesting if they actually gave you access to a building that could produce those and then you can trade them and then other people can start making them later.
Maybe.
Would that have to be the kind of thing that you can only have so many per civilization so you don't put it like a toy factory in every city?
Yeah. But that would also go back to our previous discussion that you don't put districts in every city.
Yeah.
There are multiple tourism boosting ones in here, so if you're going that fast, those are pretty important.
Yep.
Merchants are kind of universal across victory conditions.
Yeah.
You need a good economy no matter what victory.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Atomic Era boost trade route capacity for Lita Benz, but also 25% more tourism towards other civs if you have a trade route to them. See, that's a nice boost. You still have to do something after you get it, but if you do, you'll get better. And then, of course, Sarah Breedlove, same thing, another 25% boost if you send a trade route. So modern and Atomic Era, if you go hardcore merchant, you can get a boost towards touristy stuff. I'm generally okay with all the ones that give you extra trade routes. Then the actual value of that boost really depends on what you do with it. Districts give tourism. Again, this is districts or specific to campus districts for Tata. Helps with culture game. But I think the Medici, Giovanni, gives you a bank and a market, and the bank gets the two great work slots, which can hold anything. That's a nice, very, very specific.
Yeah.
The great merchant equivalent of the scientist and engineer we talked about, except as a bonus, hey, have some more tourism.
Yep. And then, yeah, all the luxury. It's just good. And then, of course, you get envoys. Merchants get envoys. Makes sense. Here's some money.
Here's money. Here's more money. Have money.
I'd actually almost say dump the get flat money and say send this merchant to another civ's commerce district and then get some multiple of the value for creating a permanent trade route.
Like Civ 4 and 5?
Yeah, or something. I kind of like that concept for, instead of just like, hey, I make money out of nothing. Thin air.
Well, it's dangerous now that these great people are immortal, so.
Well, there's that too. But I'd almost suggest it would create a permanent trigger.
Hmm.
So not boosted capacity, just a permanent connection.
And you can't pillage it?
Yeah, no pillage. You could have, like, you know, if you go to war, it turns off.
Okay.
But it would get turned back on when you're not at war again, or anywhere.
All right.
That'd be an interesting concept for a merchant. Anybody care about the get 100 faith?
Not the 100 faith part, but the free copy of currently occupied luxury resource part.
Yeah, for your capital, though.
Yeah, But that's usually your tallest.
Yeah.
So. And also, if it's something you've been having trouble getting, you can send it over into some place, into a city-state area, something. You can yoink something you couldn't normally reach, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Yep. That one fur that's sitting on that island on the other side of the continent, that there's no other fur on your continent except for that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
And you're not going to drop a city next to it anyways?
Nope.
It's still weaker than the making the amenities from nothing, but it's nice.
Well,
it's
yeah.
It's certainly still useful.
Yeah, I mean, it comes early, too, so.
Yeah.
It comes early enough that getting another luxury resource is more important than, say, more money so you can buy entertainment district stuff.
Casus Belli idea. War on Terror.
Yeah.
Brunch with Bubbles wrote on Reddit, so I just had this idea for a new Casus Belli that I think is missing from the game. If you have caught or killed an enemy spy, you gain a Casus Belli, War on Terror. In the eyes of your people, the enemy spy is a terrorist. Perhaps the Casus Belli is only gained after a number of successful spy enemy operations of a certain severity. A fun addition, your spies gain a new type of mission, false flag operations. Target your own cities masquerading as a chosen enemy attempting to gain this Casus Belli at the cost of harming your own cities a little bit. Okay? If your spies fail, you get a massive happiness and or diplomacy hit. You can now deceive your people into going to war, just like some of the most popular conspiracy theories.
Harm your own cities a bit if you succeed. Harm yourself a lot if you fail.
Yeah. Like, one way or another, it's...
At that point, just declare a formal war. Like, what the heck?
Yeah.
This isn't real-world diplomacy. You don't have to walk on eggshells quite so much. Just go smack people.
This is a great mod idea. Like, this is pretty hilarious. But I don't know about actually putting
no,
it in the game.
Not for the normal game.
I'm not sure. But in the real game, no.
You could just put in, like, a generic cut spy CB. But before we do this, can we actually make the CB system meaningful, please? Like, so that the ones that exist in the game are, like, worth significant consideration?
Yeah, pretty much at the bottom, Doc Boboy wrote, there's a lot they need to fix in the game before it comes to war diplomacy, before they get to this.
Yeah, they should definitely be earlier, they should be more specific, and they should have endings.
What CB you pick should influence what kind of war you're doing, and your ability to compel your enemy into a peace deal, rather than just being able to refuse constantly, no matter what, until you kill them completely.
Yeah.
Like, these are significant concepts that make the Casus Belli system actually work in other games that use it, such as Paradox games.
And also, it should affect your diplomacy rating with other empires, so that you don't just gain warmongering penalties. So if you have a CB, say, go liberate some city-state, and you go and do that, and you stop, no one else care. They're like, yep, you did the thing you were supposed to do.
You did exactly what you were saying. Yeah. You didn't take too much.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then you could also just, like, force the other person to give it up at some point. Of course, then again, liberating a city-state also sort of makes it a mess, because they no longer own it and you don't own it, so it gets a little weird for them to try and retake it.
Yeah, I guess. If you had a CB system like this, you could make a war like that end on successful taking of a city-state where that ends the war.
Nah, I wouldn't do that, because then you prevent the other person from being able to fight over it.
I guess, yeah. Well, then just make them be losing until they get it back.
Yeah, stuff like that. That's at least something Paradox got okay, that there's a ticking penalties for somebody getting their CB. Versus not getting the CB.
But there's taking penalties, and there's the ability to force your opponent to make peace. That's really important in lacking the Civ.
And it
completely makes the seed options, like, a joke. I mean, I know they kind of bugged it out anyway, but the fact that you can just never agree to seed cities that are taken and make them useless if they actually have the occupied penalty work the way it was intended, it's pretty asinine, and maybe that's why they took that out. But I would like to see something where you can force your opponent to make a peace deal, especially if you're asking for less than what you gained by some degree.
Yeah, I would even actually, once you hit a certain point, include other players in that peace treaty to say, okay, I went to war over this because you're a bad person, and other people agree with it, so say, if I don't cede this territory, but then everybody else is like, yeah, you do, shut up. We all believe that you ceded that territory, and guess what? That's
what international law is, basically. So you would get the penalties. They would get a penalty for refusing, diplomatic penalty with others.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, that would be nice to see some, like, agency in joint wars. I don't know how you calculate the participation.
There should be agencies in having more than one person in an alliance at a time.
Oh, that too.
Like, actually making an alliance of people. Or, we're not in an alliance, per se, but let's all joint war that guy because he's wrecking everything. And you soak up all the smaller people working together. See?
Yeah, I would actually, like, contest runaways.
Yep. Rather than all this crappy one-on-one garbage.
And the little often hates you anyway over it, unless you plan really carefully. But screw it, that doesn't matter right now. And in MP, it doesn't matter at all. Because this stuff has no basis in compelling player versus player gameplay, which is part of its flawed design.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
It's musicians. They give us music. If you're doing a cultural thing, you're trying to go for tourism, great, you get more music.
And, well, since you don't need great musicians for a tourism victory, you can get it without it.
You just want one victory condition, the rest of the time, meh.
And even then...
all equally useless.
And even then, not that useful for the victory condition. Artifacts. All about the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we rate the artifacts? How about that? I'm sorry I said that, because you know that's going to be in the next episode.
Yeah. In 2 weeks.
But guess what? I won't be here, so I won't have to deal with it.
Mm. Oh, we'll save it for you.
Yeah,
we'll Dan, make it your topic.
No.
Yeah. Yes.
It was your idea, after all.
You volunteered yourself.
No, I did.
Now Dan will voluntold you.
I think that's...
You didn't build us an ending.
I don't want to build an ending.
You didn't even have, like, a topic line that says get out.
I said out. Outro.
No, he just wrote outro.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Mike
okay.
W.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have to wrap it up?
Yep.
But I'm not going to rap, so...
Oh, on the spot, do it.
No, forget it. Forget it, Phil.
Wise choice.
Don't troll me.
I wouldn't try it either.
Don't troll me. No, 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 no.
Phil, not trolling. You're funny.
Telling
no,
me.
No, 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 no.
What? Of all people, you're telling me not to troll.
Yeah.
Well, I never.
This was Polycast episode 289 with Kyle.
Yep, hi there. Yeah, time to go back to chasing my one-year-old instead of playing Civ like I want to now, but those are the breaks.
Makalua.
Time for caffeine replenishment.
The me and team.
Rapidly expanding my diplomatic influence.
And Metrin.
Making people want to play Civ 6 again by talking about a better version of Civ 6. Oh, since Mackie's not here, I guess this is not really good.
Bad Mackie.
The Mackie thread.
Bad Mackie. Not being here.
Well, we can delay that at least. Maybe she'll turn up later.
All right.
And if not, we'll have to dock her pen a little bit.
Well, let's jump to the next one then.
Wait, do we get paid?
That's the first I heard of that.
Speaking about stuff people want to see happen. Hey, Mackie. We're going back
to
your...
Mackie. We're doubling back to your topic.
Yeah.
Mackie?
maybe we're not. Mackie, are you there?
Oh, man.
Since Mackie seems to be gone again, let's flip into the next topic. Okay, so since Mackie's pretending to be back again, should we get back to her original topic?
And to Dan, have fun editing this.
Oh,
man. Sucker.
Bye, see everybody.
Record date?
September 2nd, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.